Welcome to another episode of Reversing Inflammation Summit, Body and Mind Longevity Medicine. And I'm very pleased in this hour to have speaking with me, Dr. Daniel Kelly. And Dan is the director and one of the four co-founders of the Pacific Neuroscience Institute, a multi-specialty group of over 35 physicians working across 9 centers of excellence. And more recently, he's the creative force behind the Pacific treatment and research in psychedelics labeled the TRIP program. Dan, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Steve and Rob, for inviting me to participate. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Let's get started by telling the audience what attracted you to working with psychedelics.
Well, I've been a neuroscientist, I would say, for, much of my adult life, going into neurosurgery after medical school, doing clinical research and clinical trials for a long time, mostly around brain tumors, pituitary tumors, traumatic brain injury. I did a lot of TBI research when I was at UCLA. But I had an interest in psychedelics from many moons ago when I was much younger that never quite went away, but, and then it was all, of course, put aside for many, many decades. And then I saw it coming back, as we all know, in the last 10 to 15 years. And I really wasn't paying attention, I must say, until about 5 years ago. And it really caught my attention, in part because at the time, at Pacific Neuroscience, we were starting to develop our concept around a brain health center. And we developed our Pacific Brain Health Center, which was our last center of excellence that we created in 2018. And as I learned more and more about psychedelics and psychedelic-assisted therapy, I could see that there was really a lot going on there and a lot of potential, for mental health disorders. And it seemed to me that any self-respecting neuroscience institute, if they really wanted to stay current and be involved in cutting-edge research, that psychedelic science and psychedelic-assisted therapy was something that we needed to get involved in.
Right, right. I certainly agree with that. Before we dive into the psychedelics, can you give me your concept or perspective on longevity and aging?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Longevity, I see of as living well longer. If you're decrepit and frail and you're falling down a lot and you're not thinking clearly, but you're still alive, I'm not sure that is for me, that's not a form of longevity I would like to see. I think there's a lot of potential for healthy aging and living a fuller, more thoughtful, more cognitively intact, and physically fit life. And to me, that's what longevity is all about. So that would be my definition of longevity.
Yeah. Yeah. And certainly when we're talking about health span, for example, and quality of life, certainly the mental, emotional aspect really comes into play quite a bit. Can you talk about what are the most studied psychedelic medicines currently in clinical trials, and what disorders are they addressing?
Right. So the two most studied right now are psilocybin and MDMA. Psilocybin, which comes from magic mushrooms, but is made synthetically now for most of the clinical trials. And it's being looked at for a wide array of mental health disorders, but most commonly right now for depression, also for anxiety, end of life, existential crisis, that sort of thing. And MDMA, on the other hand, which is a synthetic, also known as ecstasy, and a different is it's an amphetamine base. It's also considered more of an empathogen, and it has been studied most intensively for PTSD. In terms of the timing and the track, The MDMA studies are much further along thanks to MAPS and Rick Doblin's work over now, you know, more than 30 years of working on getting MDMA assessed and hopefully rescheduled. They've completed 2 phase 3 trials. One was published, very positive for all across all types of PTSD. And the other one has just been completed. And I think the results will actually be out sometime within the next, you know, month or two. And then they will work to try and get it rescheduled and approved for use clinically for PTSD. Psilocybin is now in phase 2 trials. Both USONA and Compass have completed 2 phase 2 trials for either major depression or treatment-resistant depression. With positive results, those 2 arms of depression will both likely be going into phase 3 trials. They are going into phase 3 trials this year. So those are the 2 that are leading the way right now.
So can you give us a little bit of your experience in the work that the specific work that you're doing at the TRIP Center?
Yes.
And some of the initial results that you've gotten.
Right. So we were fortunate to be able to form the Treatment and Research in Psychedelics program at PNI, the TRIP program. It's led by Keith Heinzerling, who's an addiction medicine specialist and really doing an amazing job. I've been helping quite a bit. We have some amazing psychedelic guides. We've been able to complete 2 clinical trials. The first, and both with psilocybin, both in collaboration with USONA. The first was an investigator-initiated trial looking at alcohol use disorder. And this was actually a collaboration with Louis Schwartzberg, the filmmaker who did Fantastic Fungi. And we had a protocol in which individuals, it was open label, so everyone got psilocybin. They got two psilocybin journeys separated by 4 weeks. And they were randomized to either have this visual healing component to the set and setting model or to standard set and setting with eye shades and music. And so the hypothesis was that watching a nature connected video that Louis curated for us, approximately 40 minutes at the beginning of their journey, might help an individual achieve have a higher likelihood of achieving a mystical experience and potentially a higher likelihood of reducing their drinking to a greater degree. Mm-hmm. So we did that trial. It was 20 individuals. We completed the trial. We're looking at the data now. I can tell you we don't have published data, but we did see a dramatic decrease in drinking behavior in both groups, those that had the standard set and setting, you know, eye shades and music, and those that had the visual healing. Hopefully this will be published within the next, you know, several months, but similar to what other studies have shown, there was a paper out by Dr. Bogenschutz and group at NYU with a larger group with a randomized trial for alcoholism and psilocybin. Very, very positive results. So we have that alcohol use disorder study. And then we also participated in the multi-site trial with USONA for major depression. And we enrolled a number of patients for that trial. USONA is in the process of finalizing the data analysis on that. And as I, you know, indicated, I think the results will likely be positive as other trials have been and will lead to a phase 3 trial. We're also in the midst of just starting a trial related to with the use of LSD for anxiety. And then we have an investigator-initiated trial that we'll probably be doing for patients with brain tumors. And as you may know, in most of the trials to date, patients with intracranial lesions, brain tumors in particular, have been excluded. And we think that they probably don't need to be excluded, provided they don't have an active seizure disorder. So we're hoping to do that. And we have some other things in the pipeline as well.
That's interesting. I had thought my friend and colleague Chuck Grobe originally did some of the early research where I think they were terminally ill brain cancer patients.
So My understanding in that original study that Charlie Grove did, they had extracranial cancers.
Okay.
I don't think any of them had brain cancers. And all the studies prior, the larger studies have excluded brain tumor patients.
Okay.
And I think, as you know, being a brain tumor surgeon, I see lots of these patients. They have a tremendous amount of mental anguish and existential crisis. And I think many of them could greatly benefit. And now that, you know, the word is out sort of on psychedelic assisted therapy, and our patients tend to be fairly educated, a lot of them are asking about it. And I think there is a need. So hopefully this is a trial that we'll get done, and we'll get some good safety data, at least on our pilot trial.
So I noticed one of your groups, the goal was hopefully to produce a mystical experience. I know there's some research that shows that perhaps the fact that's most significant in terms of remediation from depression is inducing a spiritual experience. What was your experience around that?
Well, I can't cite any of our specific data, but certainly many of our patients, probably the majority, had what we would qualify as a mystical experience based on this mystical experience questionnaire. There's a few sort of validated scales that are used. And so certainly we're seeing that in our patients as well. As to whether it correlates with their ability to reduce their drinking, I don't have that data yet, but we will. We certainly will be having that data. Yes.
So these psychedelic medicines are thought to be neuroplastogens. Can you give the evidence for such neuroplasticity?
Right. Well, there's been some very good animal studies over the years looking at the classic psychedelics, psilocybin and LSD, also looking, I believe, at DMT, and then also even within the MDMA literature and ketamine, which, as you know, is used off label now in a psychedelic assisted therapy model. All of them are neuroplastogens to some degree. With the classic psychedelics, you know, there is evidence that through things such as mTOR, mammalian target of rapamycin, BDNF, some of these other neurotrophic factors, that they actually promote long-term changes in the brain, which including synaptic density or dendritic sprouting, those sorts of things, and essentially neurogenesis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think about what is so fundamentally different about psychedelic assisted therapy, you compare to the sort of daily pharmacopoeia approach of a daily medication for anxiety or depression, you have to ask, well, how is it that one psilocybin journey or two psilocybin journeys can make someone stop their drinking or be less depressed for, you know, 6 months, a year, or perhaps, you know, for the rest of their lives? So there's some durability process going on. There's some change. And I think the basic science data in the laboratory and the clinical data showing this durability are sort of coming together in a nice way to show that the only way this could be happening is if these are in fact neuroplastogens. They're somehow allowing the brain to regrow new connections. And through these new connections, people are being able to modify their behavior, you know, or understand their behavior and have, you know, lasting behavioral change. So I don't pretend to understand the deep neuroscience of it. I don't think anyone does.
Right.
I think this is part of the reason why this is such a fascinating area of the neurosciences right now, and there's so much good work to be done ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. And yes, the fact that a single session can have such tremendous long-lasting impact it points to other potentials for this approach. So how might the neuroplastic sense of psychedelics and psychedelic-based therapy, how might that impact aging and longevity?
Well, if you take a couple, you know, I was thinking about this with the focus on longevity. If you just take a disease like alcoholism or depression, those are life-shortening diseases, right? By a large amount. You know, some alcohol studies I've read, you know, 10 or 20 years, a couple decades maybe off your life for someone who drinks heavily. So if you can essentially stop someone from drinking themselves to a much shorter life because they reframe their relationship with alcohol, well, that's going to have a pretty huge impact on longevity on that individual. So instead of dying, you know, at 55, they may die at 75. But that's more on a sort of a behavioral modification approach. You know, you're ending this risky behavior, and to take a depressed patient, you're not going to commit suicide. So that is automatically going to have a huge impact on longevity. The other interesting area that I think really needs study is, can these molecules, and some at even potentially sub-psychedelic doses, can they somehow create enough new connectivity, dendritic increase, you know, synaptogenesis, however it's measured, can that in itself allow someone to, you know, function at a higher level, a more cognitively higher level, and potentially lead to, you know, longevity, to translate into better, fuller, more functional life?
Yeah, even in the longevity realm, we can divide the approaches to how do you sort of correct for disability, how do you correct for impairment on the one hand, but the other is, if you have a healthy person, how do you help that person live longer? And we may be looking at, you know, a couple different sets of mechanisms, but here we can talk about psychedelics as they're currently used, but if and when they are reclassified so that they're available to more people, can you imagine, think of psychedelics for the betterment of the well?
Yeah, I think that's a very big question, and I do see it as a potential way to extend people's lives and livelihood. We have a long ways to go, and obviously we all have to be very careful about how much hype there is and promotion of this now. But I do think the betterment of the well is a concept that is worth exploring, simply because, from what we can tell with these molecules, certainly with things like psilocybin and LSD, they seem to be quite safe physiologically. They're not addictive. They don't, you know, have marked changes in blood pressure, et cetera. And so I think it's worthy of pursuing. You know, we have these sort of foundational elements of diet, exercise, and sleep. Is this another, you know, overlay of something to extend things a little bit longer, perhaps?
Right. So we've talked about, you know, single doses, but what's coming into play more and more is the use of psilocybin, LSD, other psychedelics in a microdosing protocol. Can you say something about that and what your thoughts of how that might be effective?
So there's not a lot of good data on this. There's a lot of anecdotal data from people like James Fadiman, who wrote a book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide about a decade or so ago, a very good book. And he back in the day, even in the 60s, he did some interesting microdosing work. And a lot of people have been doing it more and more. It's certainly out there in the community. Microdosing essentially means using a sub-psychedelic dose. So for LSD, that would be probably 10 to 20 micrograms of LSD. For psilocybin, you know, with a sort of standard large dose that we give in the clinic is 25 milligrams. So 2 to 3 milligrams, something like that. or, you know, 0.2 grams of dried mushrooms. The so-called Fadiman protocol is to do this every third day. Most people don't really notice that they're on it, but they do notice some improvement in perhaps their mood, the way they look at things, their appreciation of others. They're maybe not as edgy. And I think we need some studies done on this. You know, what one area that I think is a really interesting area, and this also gets toward longevity, is in the realm of dementia and mild cognitive impairment. You know, could a microdosing regimen of, say, LSD over the course of 6 months change the course of someone who with MCI, instead of going on into full-blown Alzheimer's, actually plateau or perhaps even improve? And you know, I mentioned that in part because some of these animal studies that have been done have been using, they've looked at dose ranges. And LSD, I think, is particularly potent. And obviously, it's extremely potent when, you know, you can have a major psychedelic experience on 100 micrograms. It's just a, you know, very small amount of the molecules. But so they, these initial animal studies have shown some significant changes in, you know, neurogenesis and synaptogenesis, even with these small doses. You know, the question is it good synaptogenesis? I mean, you can have rewiring of the brain, but it may be of no benefit. It may not help cognition or memory. So we just don't know, but I think it's a really intriguing question, and probably someone will be doing that research in the future, I think.
Well, it certainly gives the potential raw materials for some positive results if you're increasing synaptogenesis. I mean, that's one of the issues with any kind of dementia. So,
right.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if maybe that in conjunction with some other approaches might be able to direct that, those changes.
Right. Well, you know, we just published a paper recently in a neurosurgery journal, and it was really focused at neurosurgeons and neuro-oncologists because my colleagues who I work with very closely, most of them know nothing about the psychedelic renaissance or psychedelic-assisted therapy. They know a little, but they don't really know too much. And so this was really a sort of a level set effort to educate them on the basics of what's going on in psychedelic science now, and potential applications relevant to neurosurgery, neuro-oncology. And I think one of the interesting things is, you know, we treat in neurosurgery, we do deep brain stimulation mm-hmm. or Parkinson's disease. And there's some potential thought of using it in things like depression or OCD or anorexia. And you could, and at the same time, those exact same illnesses are being assessed in psychedelic assisted therapy trials, right? So you could potentially look at synergy between those two techniques. Mm-hmm. You could use neuromodulation through TMS, transmagnetic stimulation, or DBS, and add on to that a microdosing regimen, for example, and you might get a synergistic effect. So I think there's so many possible studies to be done out there and interesting, you know, novel avenues in this realm that we're just scratching the surface.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, talking about synergy, I have spoken with a couple of people who have been trying out the effectiveness of rapamycin mm-hmm. In conjunction with ketamine for depression. And initial findings seem to be that it actually enhances the effects on depression of ketamine by adding the rapamycin, which actually turns down mTOR.
Wow. Okay. That's a very interesting thought. There was also another recent paper with ketamine, a single dose of ketamine for depression, where then after, in one group, they had them do sort of a task of sort of positive visualization. I'm forgetting the exact task that they did, but the bottom line was that it's a concept of this sort of window of opportunity, this period, this critical opening period, that where the effect of the ketamine or another psychedelic can have, you know, you can multiply or synergize the effect if you add this additional sort of learning stimuli. And so I think that's another area where you could have potential synergy that could increase the durability of the effect, which is what they showed in the group that had this visualization technique. The durability, the lifting of their depression lasted significantly longer than in the control group.
Yeah, so we may get to a place where we use one or another of these psychedelics as a tool to enhance the use of some other approach.
Yes.
Yeah.
Priming, sort of priming the tank.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. I believe your laboratory is planning on introducing 5-MeO-DMT to your work. What additional value do you expect by adding that? And can you explain to the audience what exactly that molecule is doing?
Well, 5-MeO-DMT is another one of the classic psychedelics, and it's in the same general class of psilocybin and LSD, is a tryptamine, and it's also the compound known as found in the toad venom, and it's a very relatively short acting psychedelic or hallucinogen, and very profound. It's been described as blasting off into space and, you know, becoming particulate matter with a deep sense of nothingness. We are probably going to be involved in a clinical trial, I believe for depression. I don't know too many of the details on that. But it's another compound that is out there that can now be made, you know, synthetically, obviously, and will be explored like psilocybin is now, and LSD and MDMA.
Well, it certainly makes certain aspects of research more possible because it's as short acting as you describe.
Right, and you know, I think there's a lot of individuals out there trying to create designer molecules that, in fact, are much shorter acting. We know that you can have a profound mystical experience with 5-MeO-DMT. Whether you can, you know, modify some of these molecules to get a much shorter experience, whether that's going to be sufficient, I think that's a question that people have. Is there a point where you shorten it so much that it's not meaningful?
Mm-hmm.
5-MeO-DMT it's already there. It's already very short, and I think we'll just have to see how that works in terms of resolving people's issues, you know, regarding whatever the target is, whether it's depression or anxiety or addiction.
Right. You you know, set and setting of the use of psychedelics is so important. Could you make a few comments about that and what your experience has been?
Yeah, I think that all the clinical trials that are done now use this so-called set and setting model, set being the mindset of the individual, what their issues are, their life history, what their intentions are. Setting is the place, you know, the room, or if it's done outdoors, who the guides are, and very importantly, the music. And this combination of set and setting is really what I think is so critical to having a safe and hopefully profound transformational journey. That is having experienced guides, having guides that kind of understand the spectrum of behavior, of encounters that people may have, making sure that the mindset of the individual, that they have a sense of, you know, trust and trust of the individuals, trusting the process, and sort of fortitude about going into this experience, because, you know, these are obviously very powerful substances, and sometimes the medicine will take people to very dark places. And this is where sort of the important things probably happen. And as you know, the mantra that's often used is trust, let go, and be open. You know, trust the process, let go of your rigidity, of your attempt to control the process, and be open to what unfolds. And so I think that this set and setting model, which was really probably originally described by Timothy Leary and his colleagues back in the day, has really in a way stood the test of time and is really an important model. And it goes back beyond Timothy Leary. It's this sort of shamanic model that we owe a lot to be able to do the work. Yeah. So it's a critical part of the treatment model.
Yeah, referring to the shamanic model, I know that many of the indigenous proponents of psychedelics, ayahuasca and others, these shamans, for them, they revere these substances and they consider them being handed down by the gods for sacred use, and that they become concerned about these substances being used for just recreational purposes. Do you have any kind of perspective on that?
I think we owe a lot of respect and gratitude to those, you know, cultures over the centuries and going way back, you know, perhaps back as far as 5,000 years or more. I don't think we would be where we're at if it weren't for those cultures bringing these to us in the West and around the world. And I think when I did the training at the California Institute of Integral Studies, I've done the psychedelic training there. There's a lot of respect and gratitude paid to these indigenous cultures. And I think not only because they've been doing it for so long, but in fact, it's a model that seems to work. You know, this is a model that in a way has been road tested in the, you know, in the so-called clinic the indigenous clinic. And so it's very important that respect be given.
Yeah, I certainly would agree. Parenthetically, many, many years ago, I was involved with an organization called Rock Medicine. Hmm. And we would actually go to rock concerts, and we would set up rooms where we worked with and treated people who are having bad trips, which of course we always had visitors in those settings. Yeah.
Well, and I think that you know, that's exactly right, and that's what happened. I mean, people took it out of sort of the context where it was originally being practiced, and you know, Timothy Leary and Ram Dass, that before he was Ram Dass, they had good intentions, but then it went, you know, out of academia and, you know, off the reservation and off the rails, and lots of people were getting hurt because they are powerful medicines, and there was no set and setting. They didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, and so, you know, the actual research is showing that perhaps some of the most potent factors in getting results is the spiritual nature of these experiences, and so that's, to me, that's another interesting factor here on how that has an impact on us.
Right. You know, when we designed the alcoholism trial in collaboration with Louis Schwartzberg, I mean, this was really the hypothesis that this nature connectedness was an important part of the experience, and this watching this beautiful video with beautiful music would be a way to sort of launch the person into what ultimately would hopefully be a mystical experience. And I think, you know, a lot of the clinicians in this space, those of us that are nature lovers, I think most of us are, feel that eventually we need to we try to work that into these paradigms. You know, it's very hard to do when you're dealing with IRBs and clinics and big healthcare systems, to say, you know, we want to do a trial in the outdoors. That's going to take a while, and it may be a long time before we can do that. But I do think that will be another area that's looked at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, as we're having this conversation, I'm thinking about one of the concepts that I use to talk about resilience, which I believe is associated with longevity. And I talk about how we as an organism are an instrument, and we get tuned to different things. Like we get tuned to the lessons of our childhood, or we are tuned even earlier than that to the stress response, the survival response that we engage every day. We're tuned to a model of the stress response that's not our current environment. We're tuned to the wrong environment from a evolutionary perspective. We're tuned to a wrong environment from a developmental perspective. And I'm wondering, with the use of psychedelics, if it's helping to retune our organism, in a sense, to a more sort of universal grounding based on nature, based on spirituality, that might help our organism function better for greater longevity.
I think you're definitely onto something. I absolutely agree with you. And I think many, many others, including people like Terence McKenna, would think so as well. So yeah, I think psychedelics help us get back to the essence of how lucky we are to be here on this planet, how beautiful it is. All the opportunities we have, the ability that we have, this, you know, cognitive ability to actually see it, appreciate it, hopefully make it better. That increasingly seems to get lost on way too many people on the planet. And it's just a grind to survive. Right. So yeah, I think the nature connectedness is really an important theme. And I just wanted to add that, you know, as I'm sure you know, there's many centers like this already that are out in nature, you know, in the Netherlands, for example, in Jamaica, in Costa Rica, areas outside of the United States where this sort of shamanic model out in nature is being practiced. I'm sure such things are being planned in Oregon already, mm-hmm. probably in Colorado too. And it's this is coming as well. I just, it'll be interesting to see, you know, in 5 years, we'll be having a much different conversation than we are today.
Right. Well, that leads into my next and actually the last question here is, what are you most excited about in terms of the future in this space? We've touched on it, but what would you say?
Well, I think if you look ahead from the regulatory standpoint, the clinical trial standpoint, I would say that we're hopefully looking at MDMA being approved or rescheduled in 2024. Hopefully looking at psilocybin being rescheduled for major depression, treatment-resistant depression, in maybe 2026 or 27. There may be some legislative events in different states, like there's already been in Oregon and Colorado, maybe even in California here, that will increase access. And I think, you know, every day now, Keith Heinzerling and I and our colleagues get asked, you know, how can we get involved? How can we do this? We have someone who's super depressed, who's addicted. And, you know, outside of a clinical trial, there's not many options. You know, there are options, but there's not options that we can, you know, really recommend unless you want to go out of the country. And so I'm hoping, you know, even in 5 years, that the access will be much greater, because we have this mental health crisis going on that's just enormous, and our current treatments don't really work very well. So I think we're getting close to some critical mass here. There's a lot of momentum. There's a lot of hype, you know, and we have to see how these trials play out. But hopefully psychedelic assisted therapy will become, you know, part of the standard of care for mental health disorders, you know, within a few years, at least in some locales. So that's what I'm most excited about, and that we're being, you know, we're able to participate in this with our multiple clinical trials and offering therapy for patients in need.
Well, that's great, Dan. And Rob and I are certainly going to keep coming back to you for your latest updates. And we already have plans, we'll make plans for us to come and visit your place where you're offering this treatment.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Rob. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much. Wonderful conversation. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.